Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. A couple of years ago, I attended the Parliament of World Religions in Toronto. And due to that experience, I was able to garner a few guests for this program. I did come into contact with a group with an interesting name that I never did follow up with, the Alliance for Inclusive Heathenry. Up to that point, I'd never known there were people who identified as heathens. In our Judeo-Christian-centric society, we've tended to use the words heathen or pagan as pejoratives. Certainly, I've known a number of people over my adult life who embraced their identities as pagans, but this was the first time I saw the same with heathens. As I say, I never followed up with an interview with any heathens from Toronto, but in a recent news story, I noticed the mention of heathens that piqued my interest. But I doubt this story was talking about inclusive heathenry, as it was linking the movement to white supremacy. So being an inquiring mind who wants to know, I reached out to someone who contributed to that article. Dr. Jennifer Snook was born and grew up in Germany as an army brat. She spent most of her childhood there. She received her BA from the University of Augusta in Georgia and her PhD from the University of Colorado at Boulder, then taught at the University of Mississippi. She's now at Grinnell College in Iowa. Her area of expertise is pre-Christian Northern European paganism, and she is the author of American Heathens, The Politics of Identity in a Pagan Religious Movement. So we welcome to Common Threads Dr. Jennifer Snook. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Certainly. So let's start at the beginning. Let's imagine that most people hearing us right now are in the same boat I was a couple of years ago. They had no idea that there was any spiritual movement called heathenry. So who are the heathens?
All right. Well, heathenry is a particular form of paganism. It's Northern European paganism. The word itself is used as an umbrella term. It's meant to include all of the decentralized and diffuse organizations and individuals that are actually all over the world. And the root of this system of spirituality is the mythology, the traditions, and the folklore of pre-Christian Northern Europe that heathens look to for inspiration for a particular ethos, aesthetic, and religious beliefs and practices. But it's actually really complex. Many of the groups and individuals within heathenry at large kind of do their own thing without much contact or interaction with one another. And there's no standardized heathenry, just shared source material. For many, heathenry is a way of sacralizing an intense interest and connection with an imagined past, with a feeling of continuity and connectivity to a pre-colonial, pre-modern way of thinking and living that all goes back to ancient Northern Europe. And there's, of course, a lot of ways to be a heathen. Some people practice the tradition of their ethnic ancestors. For example, if they have ties to Denmark, they might be interested in how their Danish ancestors practiced their spirituality in ancient times, or German or Norwegian, etc. But, you know, a lot of people aren't concerned with ancestry at all, and they use the history, traditions, and folklore of the whole region as a source for their spiritual imaginings. And heathenry is actually increasingly diverse. There's people of all racial and ethnic identities who practice heathenry.
You know, it's interesting because in the last, somewhere between 20 and maybe 50 years, I've noticed that there are so many different groups that may all go under the umbrella of paganism. And they're focused on particular regional identities. So you have Celtic paganism. You have the Druids. You have other indigenous religions, such as the Hawaiian religion, various Indian, American Indian movements. Is this part of that larger movement to perhaps reclaim the spirituality of pre-Christianity?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's neo-paganism is actually quite a diverse category of different spiritual movements. And so you've identified what we might call the more sort of reconstructionist movements or the revivalist movements that are really aiming at a particular kind of ethnic or regional type of paganism. So, you know, we, like you identified, Celtic Reconstructionism or Druids, you know, which are sometimes the same and sometimes different. You know, there's Egyptian Kemeticism, Kemetic Orthodoxy, that's a sort of a specifically Egyptian paganism. And, I mean, it really does run the gamut. And this is a way for a lot of people to kind of sacralize their, you know, their sort of ethnic roots, whether it's real or imagined, some kind of link to the past that's pre-Christian and that is just sort of more romantic and more epic and in many ways feels more authentic to them.
And I would imagine that many of the people who identify with these movements, and in particular heathenry, they were born and raised in a Christian culture and perhaps, maybe more often than not, raised in Christian families. Would you agree that that might be true?
Yeah, actually, that's very true. I just completed a survey. I just sent it out yesterday for a second round, but right now it has a little bit under 1,200 responses. And what I'm seeing in the data and what other scholars have seen in their data is that heathens do overwhelmingly come from Christian backgrounds.
And what is it you think is drawing them to that out of their Christianity? And another question, do some people, like I know in Ireland, there is sort of a Celtic Catholic thing going on. There's the Celtics, there's the Catholics, and then there's the Celtic Catholics. Is there anything like that in heathenry?
Not really in the United States, no, because Christianity in the United States isn't really an ethnic Christianity like it often is with the Irish Catholics, for example, where they have a very distinct Irishness to their Catholicism that's rooted, you know, in, of course, some deep history there. But we don't really have anything like that in the United States among American heathens. You know, I would say that just like the general population of Americans, heathens come mostly out of Protestantism. You know, there's plenty of Catholics. And there doesn't seem to be really any distinct reason for that. I think it's just, again, a reflection of the general population and what people are most likely to have been raised as, you know.
But if they do move from Christianity or any other religion, are they often moving out of community? That is to say, if all of a sudden I decide I want to become a heathen, there may be no other heathens in my general area. So it is often a religion or a culture that is practiced solo? Am I hearing that?
Well, yes and no. And this, of course, when I came into heathenry in the 1990s, we didn't really have the benefit of the robust network of information on the internet that we do now. It was still kind of in its infancy. And so we had to rely on other sort of pagan networks. Usually the gateway at that point was Wicca, because Wicca was the most popular form of neo-paganism in the United States and Great Britain and other European countries. And so people would usually kind of meander their way into Wicca and other forms of neo-paganism. They would find information in the, you know, the metaphysical section of their local bookstore, which had all sorts of books on how to be a witch and how to practice Wicca. And then from there, they would discover heathenry and that heathenry was an actual distinct form of paganism. And then they would sort of graduate to heathenry from there, usually finding contacts on either on the internet in sort of those early chat rooms or, you know, contact lists that metaphysical bookstores used to keep up on their walls, on their pin boards, different, you know, events that those metaphysical bookstores would host. And now what we see is because of the internet and social media, there are a lot more people practicing heathenry that came to it not even through other neo-paganisms to begin with. They just went straight there, and usually the introduction to them has been some form of media that depicted some form of ancient heathenry, because there's been a glut of media lately that depict ancient heathens, whether we're talking about the History Channel's show The Vikings, or whether we're talking about Marvel's Thor movies, or, you know, even now this new game, Assassin's Creed Valhalla. They're all depicting ancient heathenry, and so people come to it through a variety of ways now, much less than they used to, when it used to be mostly being funneled through other forms of paganism. And now they can practice on their own, because they can, you know, sit in on a bunch of social media groups and different communities online, and never have to meet another heathen person in face-to-face, although my data indicates that that's only about 14 or 15% of heathens have never met another heathen. Most of them actually do find some way to develop community to engage with other heathens face-to-face.
Do we have in the United States any opportunity for communal, I could use the word worship, perhaps the word practice might be better, or you can provide me with an even better word. Is there an opportunity there?
Both of those words are just fine, yeah, and that isn't an opportunity for people. So heathens can form little groups called kindreds or hearths, or in some cases, some of them appropriate the term tribe. And it depends on, you know, where they are and what they're doing, but a lot of these groups will, you know, have a lot of contact with each other through either, whether it's daily contact where they live together in the same neighborhoods, or they just hang out together. I've even known some groups that have shared bank accounts and shared property. And yeah, they do make an effort. There's regional gatherings that happen once a year that are quite popular, that bring people together that haven't been able to see each other because they're all over the place and they're working just like everyone else. And so it really depends on where people are and whether they're a member of a small kindred that worships regularly, or whether they're a member, you know, kind of on their own and a member of a larger organization. There's some national organizations that people can join. And those organizations have their own gatherings and their own groups that are affiliated. And so there's a lot of ways that people can get involved.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, we're speaking with Dr. Jennifer Snook from Grinnell College in Iowa. She is the author of American Heathens, The Politics of Identity in a Pagan Religious Movement. So let's talk a little bit about the theology / cosmology. If they are pagan, I'm going to assume, going out on a limb here, I'm going to assume that they have perhaps a pantheistic worldview. Would that be correct?
Yes. Yeah, they do. They are really focusing on the gods and spirits of the, you know, of sort of ancient Northern Europe. And so we're talking about gods like Thor and Odin and Frigga and Freya and Tyr and Frey, and all of these different, this whole pantheon of gods that people might be familiar with from some media, like, you know, the Marvel movies about Thor and other comic books. And so this is kind of exclusively the pantheon that heathens themselves look to for inspiration, and whether they believe the gods are actually real and physically present, or whether they believe that they're archetypes or symbols. It runs the gamut.
Very similar to Hinduism, where in terms of the understanding of who the devas or the gods are, right? That some people can look at them as archetypes, some people can look at them as celestial beings like angels. So it's along those same lines, I'm gathering.
Yeah, and heathens take it a bit further, even in that they're not just concerned with the gods themselves, but a lot of heathens spend sometimes even most of their focus on land spirits, on sort of the spirits of the land, of the area of their home that they inhabit. And so thinking about the natural world as alive and as sacred is also a huge part of heathen theology.
So I believe I'm understanding from you that what we call heathenry today has been completely reconstituted, or has there always been a little bit of heathenry alive and kicking in Northern Europe?
Yeah, that's. I think that's a question for the ages, and scholars have really been. There's a whole field of scholarship actually, where the scholars are tackling, you know, place names and archaeological digs and folklore and traditions handed down, and you know, we don't really have a very clear picture of, you know, there's no continuity, there's no unbroken chain of traditions that we can really identify as coming from pre-Christian Northern Europe, because they were so heavily colonized and forcibly converted, and a lot of the knowledge of those ancient peoples was lost. And then the literature was written down actually by Christian monks in Iceland in the 12th and 14th century. And so we have, of course, hundreds of years undocumented that then got reinterpreted through the eyes of these Christian monks. And so right now, scholars sort of face the task of picking that apart and trying to figure out, you know, what actually is an accurate and fair representation of what people might have done or might have believed, and what is sort of, you know, a Christian imposition, and, you know, what might have been sort of modern political interpretations, again, when things get retranslated. So it's actually quite a challenge to figure that out.
What do we know about the conversion of Northern Europe? Now, you say the forced conversion. Was that consistent, or were there conversion opportunities that were less forceful?
Well, that question is complex. It starts to veer outside of my realm of expertise, because that's really where we get into the history of conversion, and I'm not a historian, I'm a sociologist. But what I do know is that, you know, Northern Europe is one of the last places to be converted to Christianity, and of course, you know, there's a lot written about Charlemagne and his forcible conversion of the Saxons, and then you know, as the Christianity spread to Northern Europe and the kings and other royalty were converted, they were using Christianity as a source of political power, and it wasn't necessarily like just a devout system of belief so much as it was a political tool, right, to increase their power and sort of subjugate their people. And one of the reasons that we have the written work that we do from Iceland is because some of those people were not okay with that forced conversion, and they left Norway. They fled to Iceland to maintain their ways and their beliefs. And so that's why we have those stories that we do from there.
That's fascinating. And yet, even though they fled to Iceland, they were not able to keep up this apostolic succession, shall we say, of heathenry down through the ages. At some point, from what I'm hearing, it was extinguished, or it came really close to being extinguished. There might be some smattering of practice over there, but you're saying that has not really been discovered. That's still a work in progress, right?
It is still a work in progress. And I mean, Iceland converted in the year 1000, and you know, the stories vary whether it was amicable, whether it was a political decision. But they for years and years after that, there is evidence that they continue to practice heathenry alongside of Christianity, and whether or not that practice of Christianity was symbolic and political, or whether it was devout and meaningful, you know, scholars, I'm sure, have something to say about that.
Has there
but,
been?
Go ahead.
Has there been any attempt to either create or adopt a sacred language, such as Norse or Danish or anything? Or are people just free to speak whatever language they wish?
Yeah, that's a fun question, because in the United States, because we're both sort of divorced from the land of this you know, prior practice, like we're not on the land where this traditionally took place. So in that regard, some heathens do study Old Norse, which is the language that many of the Icelandic sagas and literature was written down in. And a lot of the rune poems and sort of the other, you know, the poetic Edda and the prose Edda. So they learn the language that these texts were originally written down in. And a lot of that gets also translated into ritual. So I spent a lot of time in the field hanging out with heathens who were using Old Norse during ritual. You know, to call on gods and you know, to offer various prayers and thanks in Old Norse, which is kind of interesting to me, that they would go through the trouble. I'm not sure that people in Iceland or Norway or Denmark, where they also practice heathenry, feel compelled to do that, because they have their own languages that are connected to this, but heathens do tend to, I mean, not a lot of them, but definitely quite a few of them learn Old Norse so that they can also study the source material and its original language, because heathens are very proud of their studiousness, right? They devote a lot of attention to historical texts and stories of gods and land spirits written down a long time ago. Along with all of this academic work on the language and the archaeology and the anthropology, and they want to read it in its most original forms. And some of them have even learned Old Norse such that they can translate these old sagas that have yet to be translated into English on their own.
Would you say that there is any comparison between Old Norse and modern Scandinavian languages and, say, Latin and the Romance languages?
From what I've heard from my scholar friends, I do think there is a connection, yes.
Mm. And where in Norse literature do we find the stories of Asgard? So for instance, if somebody is interested in Greco-Roman mythologies, mm-hmm. you have the Iliad and the Odyssey. You have really profoundly powerful epic pieces of literature. Is there anything like that from the Old Norse tradition about the deities of Asgard?
Yeah, there's quite a bit. I would say the most popular are the prose and the poetic Edda, right? Those are the main works that the myths were translated into and written down in bits and pieces in those works. And then, you know, there's also the Icelandic sagas, which are sort of these long sort of historical works of kings and empires and kind of, you know, there's quite a lot of those. But mostly I would say the poetic Eddas is the start, but it's definitely not the end. It tends to be where people first coming into heathenry look for inspiration on learning kind of the origin of the Norse myths, which, of course, you know, there's a bajillion translations and summaries of the Norse myths into story form. I think even Neil Gaiman wrote his own version of Nordic mythology. And so, you know, there's lots of those books, but they come mostly from the prose and poetic Edda. And then, you know, there's also the writings of Saxo Grammaticus and Tacitus and Bede and all these other historical figures who wrote things down a long, long time ago that people also fill in the blanks with.
I'm curious. I know that, maybe 20 years ago or so, there was a movement for the people who identify them as pagans or Wiccans to join the interfaith movement here in Michigan. And I, of course, welcome them with open arms. Other people did not. I remember one particular time when somebody asked me to put together an interfaith panel, and I asked a Jewish woman and a Jewish Wiccan both to be on that panel, because the person who was putting together the panel, he says, well, what religions can I have? Well, you can have this, you can have that. He goes, oh, Wiccan, yeah, I'll take one. I'll take somebody Jewish too. Okay, great. So we put together this panel, and finally the Jewish woman said, I'm not going to be on a panel with a Wiccan. But for the most part, there has been some wonderful inclusion here, and I'm just curious if you know, number one, are heathens interested in joining interfaith movements? And number two, how are they accepted, if they are?
To number one, yes, absolutely. There are heathens who are interested in joining interfaith movements and who, in fact, are very active in their own local interfaith movements in their communities. You know, as you started the show today, you talked about your experience at the Congress of World Religions, and, you know, heathens do attend those, and they do outreach, and they do ministries, and they are absolutely interested in this interfaith dialogue, because it's really crucial for being taken seriously and for undoing the damage done by those white supremacists you mentioned early on. And to the second question, you know, they tend to be, I think, well-received when they're well-intentioned, and they take great pains and make great efforts to make it very clear that they are not white supremacists, that they are usually very progressive, minded, very open, and, you know, that heathenry itself is a faith with like an entire history and foundation in its own regard, divorced from any of these sort of political interpretations foisted upon it by others.
Which opens up a whole other cave of discussion for us, which we will continue next week, Jennifer, because we're out of time right now. But I want to thank you so much for what you've given us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today has been Dr. Jennifer Snook from Grinnell College in Iowa. She is the author of American Heathens, The Politics of Identity in a Pagan Religious Movement. Please join us again next week when we continue our conversation here on WGVU.